The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.
As we head into our lunchtime, Doctor, for today, and I do believe at 12:30, we'll be talking to our friends at Dalton Brong Optometrist. So let's turn it over right now to Dr. Brittany Dean. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Bees, and good afternoon to all our listeners out there. And of course, a new day and a new opportunity to learn about our health. So today we're going to be talking about a very interesting topic that I think everybody should be aware of. Not everybody is going to, of course, experience this particular form of disease, but it is something that you need to be aware of for family members or friends or people in your close vicinity. So today we're going to be talking about allergic reactions, but not just allergic reactions in general, severe allergic reactions, and that is what we will term anaphylaxis.
All right, so let's get into that. Somewhere midway in between our questions, we'll be taking some questions from you. Right, maybe you didn't get through to get us to us yesterday. But of course, 625-2257, 627-3223. We're also on Sangeet 106.1 and Sky 99.5. You can send your questions there and they will send it to us right here in studio. So let's start it. In terms of our questions, what is a severe allergic reaction and how is it different from a mild allergy?
So when we look at severe allergic reactions, we actually term that in medicine anaphylaxis. And what that really refers to is a rapidly developing, potentially life-threatening reaction. And that is caused when the immune system starts to respond excessively to something that is usually harmless, like a food or a medication or an insect bite. Now, during the reaction itself, your immune cells start to release certain substances. So they release something called histamine and other inflammatory chemicals as well. And all of those chemicals actually cause a person's airways to start to narrow, and it causes their throat and their tongue to swell up. And it also causes their blood vessels to dilate and start to leak fluid, and even their blood pressure can fall very dangerously. And the thing about anaphylaxis is that several areas of the body can be affected at once. So the skin, the respiratory system, the heart and circulation, the digestive system. However, a person does not need to have every single possible symptom to be experiencing anaphylaxis. Any sort of sudden problem that starts to involve breathing and the throat or blood pressure after exposure to something that we call an allergen should be treated as a severe allergic reaction, even when there's no sort of rash or hives or anything like that. If the person has taken a bite of something new and they start to have breathing problems and they feel like their tongue and their throat is swelling up, that needs to be taken seriously. You don't need to see a rash on it for somebody to be taken to the emergency department. Now, when we're looking at a mild allergic reaction, that is usually very limited to certain symptoms. So somebody may get a small area of itching or a few hives or sneezing and watery eyes, and they may feel congested in their nasal passages, but they do not have that difficulty breathing. They do not get those throat symptoms. They don't faint or have any sort of circulatory collapse in their body. And I think that the dangerous mistake that people make is assuming that a reaction will remain mild because it just started with a simple itch or a rash. Severe reactions can also begin with apparently very mild or minor symptoms, and then they progress very rapidly. Many people think that anaphylaxis, which is a severe allergic reaction, is the same as anaphylactic shock. And I'm sure that many people have heard that terminology before. But anaphylaxis actually refers to just the overall severe allergic reaction. But when you get into anaphylactic shock, that specifically describes anaphylaxis that has caused critically low blood pressure and inadequate blood flow to a person's vital organs. So somebody can have life-threatening anaphylaxis because of airway swelling or severe breathing difficulty even before anaphylactic shock develops.
And what are the most common causes of severe allergic reactions, and can they happen to anyone?
So some of the most common triggers that we do see would be foods, medications, insect venom, if somebody has gotten an insect bite, and even latex. So the food triggers in particular, it tends to vary between individuals. And most commonly, things we would see is like the peanuts and the tree nuts, so the shellfish, sometimes fish, sometimes milk, eggs, wheat, other foods. Anybody can be mount an immune response or develop an allergic reaction to any specific type of foods, but these are the main ones that we do see being the culprits for most people. Now, when it comes to medications, people can be allergic to certain antibiotics or painkillers and medications that are even given during medical procedures like anesthesia. All of those things can also cause very severe reactions. Bees, wasps, other stinging insects, all of those things can also trigger anaphylaxis in sensitized people. Latex is less common than it was before, but it remains a possible trigger, and we do see it sometimes. But less familiar causes would be like somebody mounting an immune response to exercise or exposure to the cold, or particular combinations like eating a specific food before exercise and substances that are used during procedures. Sometimes, even though we may investigate very thoroughly, we may sometimes not even find a definitive trigger, and that is what we term idiopathic anaphylaxis. Now, severe allergic reactions can occur in both children and adults, and that will also include people who previously considered themselves very healthy, but they do not occur because somebody has a weak immune system or is immunocompromised. In fact, an allergy represents an inappropriate immune response to a particular substance, and it's not a general weakness of the person's immune system. So a person usually has to become sensitized to an allergen before developing that allergic reaction. But earlier exposure may also have just gone unnoticed for some people, or it may have occurred through a related substance for some people as well. And having seasonal allergies, so some people may have allergic rhinitis or allergic sinusitis, and that might be during pollen season. It may come out more during the Sahara dust, but that does not automatically mean that somebody is going to experience anaphylaxis, and neither does having one food intolerance as well. Now, intolerances like difficulty digesting lactose in lactose intolerance people, that generally does not involve the same immune mechanism, and they do not typically produce the sudden airway swelling or the circulatory collapse that we would see in somebody who has a severe allergic reaction like anaphylaxis. So there are two different mechanisms of action. So just because you are food intolerant does not mean that you are allergic or will mount an allergic response to that particular food.
All right, folks, once again, you could send your questions at WhatsApp. We'll be answering them in just a short while. You're listening to The Lunchtime Doctor, and soon we will have our friends at Dalton Brown Optometrist. Can someone suddenly develop a severe allergic reaction, even if they have never had allergies before?
Yes, definitely. A person can actually develop an allergy at almost any age. Even after previously eating that same food or taking that same medication or being stung without a problem. The immune system may actually become sensitized during an earlier exposure and will react during a later one. Now, in other cases, the person may have experienced very subtle symptoms previously and they did not recognize them as allergic. Now, allergies can also change over time. So some childhood food allergies resolve while other allergies persist or first appear during adulthood. Therefore, you know, people say they've used this before or I've used this before or they've eaten that all their life. That does not completely exclude an allergic reaction when the timing and the symptoms will strongly suggest one. But every episode of swelling, fainting, or shortness of breath should also just not be considered only an allergic reaction. It's not automatically an allergy. Asthma attacks, panic attacks, choking, heart problems, fainting episodes, certain medication side effects can all resemble parts of an allergic reaction as well. So what we do is we make the diagnosis by examining how quickly the symptoms appeared, which body systems were affected, and what the person encountered beforehand. And in an emergency setting, treatment is not delayed while we're waiting for some sort of lab confirmation of something. Anaphylaxis is primarily a clinical diagnosis, meaning that it is recognized from the symptoms and the circumstances. And yeah, we may use blood tests sometimes afterwards to support the diagnosis, but a normal or unavailable test does not reliably rule out what happened to that person.
All right, as you're saying that, somebody sent me a picture here. I'm having a sudden allergic reaction. I'm not sure how, 3 days ago. I think it's their arm and you're seeing their redness and, you know, kind of rash. But of course, sometimes do you have to do like your own process of elimination? Let's say if you ate something or you did something out of the ordinary or went somewhere, maybe you touch a piece of grass or piece of material, touch your hand. How does that work? Well, I know you're supposed to go by a doctor maybe, but is it possible to find out when you go by the doctor to give them some information?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have to, of course, in the history, we will do a recall with you. But most people come knowing that they were exposed to a certain allergen. And sometimes when you don't know that you have an allergy to something, we sort of work backwards to see what could be the most likely culprit. So for some people, they may come with something like contact dermatitis. So that is when your skin, that localized reaction happens on the skin. Some people, when they're exposed to nickel, some parts of their skin can turn green, or some parts may be red, or they may break out in hives. We have to look at every single thing that changes. So are you using a new detergent? Did you put on a new pair of clothing without washing it? All of these things can lead us to identifying what the main culprit is. Now, for that specific person that sent the picture, what I would say is that you probably are mounting some sort of allergic reaction to something that you may have come in contact with in the last few days. But you do need to go and get it sorted out in terms of getting prescribed maybe an antihistamine or the appropriate medications for what you may be going through, because sometimes your doctor has to rule out whether it's a dermatological condition versus just an allergy response to something.
I know there's some people who are allergic to shellfish, right? And sometimes they would take a tablet before they do so that they can, you know, eat and stuff. How safe is it to do that? I mean, should you do that often, you know?
So I personally, this is a personal belief, I don't think that you should be doing that, because not everybody who has a mild allergy, like I said, will mount an anaphylactic reaction or anaphylaxis to that particular substance that they're consuming. They are probably taking an antihistamine before so that you sort of prepare the system for what is to come when you are eating this shellfish. Now, that being said, it's not always the best course of action. I would say if you know that you are allergic to specific foods, the best thing to do is probably stay away from that specific food.
Mm-hmm. All right. And so I think this is what they take. Puritan. Does somebody's accent come? Yeah, Puritan, yes. Help with allergies.
Yeah. So Puritan, any sort of other antihistamines, all of these things. Essentially, remember, I said that your immune cells actually disperse certain substances. Histamine is one of them. So Puritan is an antihistamine, and what it helps to do is just relieve the symptoms of the mild allergic reactions that people may get, like hives or itching or rashes, all of those.
All right, and what are the warning signs that a severe allergic reaction is becoming life-threatening?
I would say the most important warning signs will involve the person's airway, their breathing and circulation, or even their level of consciousness. So airway symptoms would be the person is experiencing swelling of the tongue or the throat, their voice may become very hoarse or altered. They may have difficulty swallowing, drooling, or a sensation that their throat is closing up as well. Now, breathing symptoms would be like wheezing, persistent coughing, noisy breathing, chest tightness, severe shortness of breath, or just difficulty speaking in full sentences. When we look at the circulatory symptoms, a person may get dizzy. They may become very confused. They may look pale or clammy. Their pulse will get very weak very rapidly. They may even collapse, or they may just lose consciousness as well. Sudden severe abdominal cramping and people who have repeated bouts of vomiting or diarrhea, all of those things can occur when somebody is mounting a very severe immune response, and that particularly when that is combined with skin and respiratory circulatory symptoms, that definitely puts in our mind that this could be anaphylaxis for this person. Now, skin symptoms would be something that people notice beforehand. For example, widespread hives and flushing and itching and swelling of the lips and the eyelids and the face. But you should not just wait for a rash before taking the situation seriously. Sometimes the rash will come after a lot of the severe symptoms appear. So do not just try to wait for the rash to say that this is an allergic reaction and I need to get help. No, any sort of severe symptom should warrant immediate medical attention. And a severe allergic reaction can occur without visible hives or skin changes as well. And conversely to that, hives alone do not necessarily mean that somebody is experiencing anaphylaxis, like I said before. The pattern that should cause immediate concern is if it is rapidly progressing and if they are having breathing or throat difficulties and faintness or involvement of more than one of the body systems after a possible exposure to an allergen. Some people have this feeling that they call a feeling of impending doom that just accompanies the physiological reaction. And that should not automatically be dismissed as anxiety, particularly when it appears with all of the objective symptoms that I listed, like the wheezing and swelling and the vomiting and even the collapse.
12:24 on time, folks. You're listening to the Lunchtime Doctor right here on Freedom 106.5 FM, Sangit 106.1, Sky 99.5. In about 6 minutes' time, we'll be dealing with our friends out there at Dalton Brown Optometrist. We have some more messages here from our listeners. I'm not allergic to seafood, but on Saturday I ate fish and chips at the movie center, and next day got up itching in my arm. This is the same person with the arm, so could that have been, obviously, if they noticed it, if that was their observation, could that have been the cause of their allergic reaction?
It can be the cause of their allergic reaction, but I would not just say that it's the fish and automatically assume that. There are many different things that this person could have been exposed to. It could have been they've changed their detergent, like I said, and now they're getting rashes on their arms. It could have been maybe even the oils that was used to cook the fish and the chips. It could be so many different things. So I can't say that this is the definite thing that we've pinpointed, but it is definitely a possibility.
All right, someone here is messaging about something else. I'm 60 years old, and sometimes in the daytime, when I'm walking, a drop of urine comes out. And they say they also take blood pressure tablets.
So what can be happening is probably urinary incontinence. What we look at here is, of course, as you get older, the main things to look at is the muscles of the pelvic floor as well. Now, urinary incontinence is definitely something we see in women who have had pregnancies. They've given birth to child. Sometimes there's something called stress incontinence. That's when somebody coughs or sneezes or laughs, so they exercise, and then the urine just comes out, and that again caused by a weakness in the pelvic floor muscles and the tissues that support the bladder and the urethra. And we definitely see that being more common in, like I said, vaginal deliveries and after menopause as well. So your doctor is going to want to know a couple of things. You know, how many times do you urinate at night? Is there pain or burning? All of these things, we need to thoroughly investigate you. And the treatment depends on the cause of the incontinence as well. So if it's pelvic floor muscle weakness, it could be pelvic floor exercises, weight loss if the person is overweight, pessary for if you may be experiencing pelvic organ prolapse as well. So there are many different reasons why that could be occurring, but more than likely for your age, the main thing may be stress incontinence.
Let's get our final question here about the allergies before we turn over to our friends at Dalton Brown, who are already waiting on the line. If someone has had one severe allergic reaction, what should they do to prevent another one? And when should they see an allergy specialist?
So, after recovery, the person should receive follow-up to determine the most likely trigger and create a prevention plan. Now, an allergist or another appropriately trained clinician will take a detailed history, including what was eaten or what was administered, the timing of exercise, insect exposure, anything that we could think of, we will ask about that. And then you may get some targeted skin testing or blood testing that may be useful for some people. But broad panels without us doing a very targeted history can generally lead to some sort of misleading positive results in some people. Now, in very selected cases, there are supervised challenge testing that may be considered in the setting where we have the proper medications to be able to resolve anything. But the goal is not to just name an allergen. It is to determine what must be avoided, what remains safe for that person, and how the person should respond if an accidental exposure occurs. And prevention is going to involve reading labels and communicating with restaurants and identifying medication alternatives, and even for some people wearing medical identification. We don't practice that as much in Trinidad, but it's definitely a good way to let people know, especially if you know that you are somebody who is prone to anaphylaxis due to certain allergens. It is good to have that on you in case there's nobody that is familiar with you is around as well. Sometimes improving asthma control and ensuring that your relatives or your caregivers know the emergency plan as well. And people, I think that you should ask your doctor what emergency medication is realistically available. So I don't believe we have EpiPen here in Trinidad, but we do use epinephrine or adrenaline to treat those severe anaphylactic reactions. So you will have to liaise with your doctor if you have any concerns about any sort of possible allergens coming into contact with you causing that anaphylaxis. And the thing is, adrenaline ampules and syringes should not just be casually carried and used by people who are not trained in it. You may need to become trained, especially if you know that it is a real possibility of getting an anaphylactic reaction. And any personal plans need to include proper instructions for yourselves and for people around you as well. A person allergic to one medication or food, I would say, should not automatically avoid an entire unrelated range of products without, of course, your doctor's input into that.
All right, well, thank you. That's our lunchtime doctor segment for today. Well, not the entire segment. We do have our friends at our Dalton Brong optometrist on the line. So let's get ready with another topic and talk about your eyes. Let's say hi. Going out to the ladies at Dalton Brong optometrist. Good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hello.
Good afternoon. So today we're going to be talking about UV safety. And the first question is, given that school is closed and a lot of people are going on vacations or staycations, what's happening to our eyes during this month that is filled with outdoor activities?
So July is one of those times in the year when people experience a lot of UV exposure because the frequency at which that they do things like go to the beach or the river or go to hikes, the frequency of that goes up. So a lot of the kids, as well as because a lot of the kids are home for July, August vacation. So families could be outside for sometimes 8 hours straight doing different things. They might not be doing the same activity for 8 hours, but everything that you do might be outside, right? So it's only right that in the eye care community, we've taken the month of July to shed some more light on how UV affects the eyes. So over time, UV rays could damage the eyes, contributing to conditions like cataracts, things called pterygium, and long-term vision problems. So today we really want to shed some light on how those things affect the eyes and how we can make adjustments in our lives to prevent certain things from happening as it pertains to UV exposure.
What are some things people might experience when our eyes are exposed to those harmful UV rays while we enjoy our time outdoors?
So many people don't actually feel the eye damage immediately, right? It sometimes it goes very much unnoticed until several years later. So the risk of overexposure to those UV rays basically increases because the reflections from whether we're on surfaces of the water or even other surfaces, such as like if we just generally walking around concrete or the pavements or different things like that, depending on the activity. So the UV rays do hit your eyes at multiple different angles. And as a result of that, can cause several different types of eye damage, as mentioned by Ms. Albury. And prolonged exposure to UV radiation could lead to one of the most prominent ones that we do see is called cataracts. We would have actually spoken about cataracts at our last session last month, about what it is and what type of symptoms you experience with it. And basically, the cataract is a clouding of the crystalline or the natural eye lens in the eye. And when that lens becomes hazy or cloudy, we experience things such as blurred vision and over time possible blindness if surgery is not performed. Another type of eye damage that one can experience would be macular degeneration. That's where it involves the macula, the back of the eye, which is for central, fine and minute vision, as well as color vision. So it is a condition that affects the retina, leading to central vision loss. Another very prominent one that we do experience in our daily life, and we do see it very common among patients on a day-to-day basis when they're coming into the office, is something called a pterygium. A lot of the time, patients do mix up between a cataract and a pterygium. The cataract happens within the anterior part of the eye, versus the pterygium is actually on the surface of the eye. It's a white flesh-like growth that actually leads onto the iris or the colored part of the eye, and it could potentially lead to irritation and visual problems. Another type of eye damage could be photokeratitis or sunburn of the eye. So you know, a lot of times patients might think, okay, I need to wear sunblock to go outside because I can get sunburn on my skin. But you can actually have exposure with sun to your eyes, so you can get sunburn to your eyes. And this causes a lot of pain and redness and blurry vision. And as we go along in today's session, Ms. Albury is going to tell us a lot more of some of those symptoms and what we can do to potentially protect our eyes, because we live in the Caribbean, we live in the hot tropic, and we live in a beautiful island. So we want to make sure to have as much protection as we can from that sunlight.
And UV rays affect our eyes even when we are not directly in the sun?
Yeah, for sure. So UV rays could still affect the eyes when you're in the shade, for example, or if there's like reflected sunlight off of a surface. So they could bounce off of surfaces like water, they could bounce off of surfaces like snow, sand, and concrete, as Mr. Lack had just mentioned, right? So for instance, water reflects up to 100% of UV rays, whether it be from the ocean, from rivers, or even when the road itself is wet, after we've had showers, so we have a lot of rain in recent times, yeah? So even when you're walking down the road after shower rain, that water on the surface of the road could reflect the sun and well, the UV rays into your eyes as well, right? Snow also reflects UV rays even more than water, which is why skiers and snowboarders are often at risk for eye damage, or they're at least at a higher risk of eye damage, right? So for those of you that have left Trinidad to visit one of those places for the vacation, if you're staying in like a ski lodge, for example, you'd better be careful and make sure you have proper protection for the eyes, right? And then you also have sand and concrete that reflect UV rays, and they could increase your exposure. So, you know, you have lots of lovely beaches here in sweet, sweet TNT. So lots of time spent at the beach and beach times and whatnot means lots of UV exposure. So we really need to make that extra effort to protect the eyes around these times and when we're doing these different activities.
What are the signs that can indicate that your eyes are being affected by UV exposure?
So basically, if you are exposed to a high number of UV rays without any type of protection, like mentioned before, one of the main signs that you would experience would be eye redness or irritation. So that's actually a sign. And then you might experience some types of symptoms, and that would include like pain or burning sensation, even blurry vision as well, increased sensitivity to light, so that's known as photophobia. You can get watery eyes, and swollen eyelids are usually another sign as well. And this is actually an indication that you can be having some sort of sunburn to your eyes, which is known as photokeratitis. It's a very temporary, but it tends to be quite a painful condition. And some of these signs and symptoms do mimic that of dry eyes. So usually if you do experience that after being at a long day at the beach without any sort of sunglasses or such, you can come in to us and we'd be happy to look at your eyes to know exactly what's happening and make a diagnosis and therefore propose a certain management plan for you.
And as you've mentioned, photokeratitis or sunburn in the eyes, how can we protect our eyes from that? Because that sounds quite painful.
Yeah, it is really painful. And you probably feel like you could barely keep your eyes open, you know? So the best ways, or some of the best ways to protect the eyes from that UV damage is to, first of all, wear sunglasses. But you need to choose sunglasses that block 100% of the UVA and UVB rays. So you have to look at the lenses and make sure that they're marked with that that slogan, 100% UV protection or UV 400. Or some of them would also say polarized as well. You could also wear wide-brimmed hats. So a hat with a very broad brim could reduce the UV exposure to your eyes, especially when you're outdoors. So you typically see a lot of gardeners or farmers or people that are into agriculture would have those. You could try to avoid direct sun exposure. So if you could, stay in the shade when the sun is at its peak. And usually when the sun is the most harmful, is usually between about 10 a.m. to around 4 p.m. or so. You could even wear UV blocking contact lenses. So most contact lenses on the market now offer some sort of UV protection, but you have to remember that they don't fully protect the eyes because it doesn't cover the entire front surface of the eyes. It also doesn't protect the lids as well, right? So you'd want to use the contacts in conjunction with the sunglasses. And you could also wear goggles. So if you're doing activities like skiing, snowboarding, or water sports, you could get the goggles that have that UV protection built in it to try to help to protect your eyes from both the UV rays and even the wind as well. So, you know, you get two benefits from that. So those are just a few of the most common forms of the UV protection.
And is UV exposure only something we need to worry about on bright sunny days?
Oh, not at all. And this actually surprises many people. So actually up to 80% of UV rays can actually pass through the cloud. So even on an overcast day, you do get some sort of UV exposure so that your eyes are still being exposed, right? Many people actually skip their sunglasses because they're like, you know, outside is pretty much overcast today. I don't really need it, you know, I only need my sunglasses when the sun is pretty much high in the sky. But UV radiation doesn't always match how sunny it feels. In Trinidad, where we are close to the equator, UV levels remain high throughout the year. That means eye protection isn't just for beach days. It's important while you're driving, while walking to work, gardening, watching sports, or even if you're hanging laundry outside. You know, you might think to yourself, if I'm washing outside, do I really need to wear sunglasses? Mm-hmm. It might seem kind of cliche, but maybe I think you definitely should. So that way you can actually protect your eyes all around. Have you ever done that, Miss Albury?
Of course. I mean, I didn't always, but after learning what could happen to the eyes, I started to put it on more often. Even if I just walking outside to check something, I'd naturally gravitate to the region for my sunglasses. So I've put it as part of my daily routine now.
Good. Very good.
And are expensive sunglasses better than the inexpensive ones?
So this is one of the biggest myths, right? And I just had a conversation about this with one of my patients. So the price of the sunglasses doesn't determine how well they protect your eyes from the UV rays, right? What matters is that it clearly states that it blocks 100% of the UVA and the UVB radiation, or labeled UV 400 or polarized, as I mentioned, right? So a pair of designer sunglasses without proper UV protection is actually less protective than an inexpensive pair that blocks all the UV rays. Now, it's unfortunate because, you know, you're spending a lot of money to look cute and whatnot, but I mean, you're not actually getting the benefits out of what you're buying, right? With that said, better quality sunglasses may offer clearer optics, so you'll find that you see a little bit sharper, a little bit clearer. They may also be more durable, and they might be more comfortable as well. But when it comes to the UV protection itself, it's really the label on the lenses that's what matters, right? So many people choose sunglasses based on style. Now, style is kind of important because you'll wear it more often if you like how they look, but always try to find a balance between the two. So yes, find a style that you like and that suits you and that makes you feel confident, but always check for that 100% UVA and UVB protection first. So protection should always come before fashion.
And can children wear sunglasses too, or is that only for the adults?
I actually think that children should be wearing sunglasses more than adults, because I find that they spend notably more time outdoors than the average adult, because they're more likely to spend time doing sports or at the beach and different things like that. Now, yes, we have this epidemic where children are glued to their screens and whatnot, but I still have hope that there are some children out there that actually enjoy going out and riding bikes with their friends and different things like that, right? So I find that they should be wearing it more often. And I think that that's something that we don't talk about enough as optometrists. Like, it's just something that a lot of us tend to overlook, probably because we just don't notice it either. You don't walk outside and naturally see a few kids wearing sunglasses.
True.
I would probably see maybe a handful in a whole day that I go to the beach, you know? But the thing is, since UV damage accumulates over a lifetime, then you would think that protecting children's eyes earlier on might reduce the risk of them developing those UV-related eye diseases later in life. So why wouldn't you want to protect your children's eyes from the sun as early as you can, you know? So I think that parents should choose sunglasses designed for children that, again, provide the 100% UV protection and that fit comfortably and of as best as possible looks good to the kids as well, because they are even more picky than adults. If they don't like their frame, it's be a hassle to get them to wear just their regular glasses, far less for sunglasses.
Yeah, you should get something definitely to motivate their motivational way, you know, like whether you choose a specific design or color, or, you know, you have these little charms and all these things you can add to the glasses to make them want to wear it. Yeah. So definitely want something a lot fashionful with the brand.
And can you, if I'm sitting in the shade, do I still need to wear sunglasses?
We would say yes, because the shade doesn't completely block the UV rays. So it does help, and that's a good habit. Like, if you can find some shade, you should go there. But it doesn't block all the UV rays, unfortunately. So as we mentioned before, the UV rays could still reflect off of surfaces, whether it be concrete, water, windscreens from cars, different things like that. So even under a tree, or even if you're under an umbrella, the UV rays could still be reflected and reach to your eyes, right? So you could think of shade as reducing your exposure rather than completely eliminating it. So combine the shade with sunglasses or a hat or an umbrella, because they would offer much better protection than just relying on the shade alone.
And can UV rays actually cause blindness?
The UV exposure alone doesn't usually cause sudden blindness, but over many years, it can increase the risk of several eye diseases that may eventually impair vision if left untreated. So, for example, just tying back to something Mr. Lack said at the beginning, cataracts are one of the leading causes of vision loss worldwide, and long-term UV exposure is known as a well-known risk factor for cataracts, right? And UV could also contribute to pterygiums, which may play a role in other eye conditions. So a good example for this is, I don't know if any of our listeners were as engrossed in the World Cup as I was, but the Cape Verde goalkeeper was trending for a bit online, not just for his exceptional skills, because he was amazing, but because the audience noticed that he had a pterygium on one of his eyes. So, as you mentioned before, pterygium is a growth at the front surface of the eye that could eventually block your visual access. So it would impair your vision when it grows over the pupil, right? Now, obviously, we don't see those footballers wearing sunglasses all the time. They don't wear it in any of the matches, actually. So it was obvious that, for me, it was obvious that after all these years of intense training, being in the sun, that he would have developed something like that. And it's a real thing. He's not the only person. We have so many patients that walk in. Like, let's say their jobs involve being outside a lot, they tend to have a little growth the first time we see them, and then as they come back over the years, it grows a little bit more, and we have to manage them and try to counsel them on when would be the time to remove it, right? So I'm actually surprised that other players didn't have it too in the World Cup, or maybe they did have it once upon a time and then they just did the procedure to remove it, you know? But imagine, even by doing the things that you love and that brings you income and that you're passionate about, can result in eye conditions just because you're not properly protecting the eyes from the sun, you know? So the important message is that protecting your eyes today is an investment in your vision years from now.
And in addition to that, what time of the day is UV exposure strongest?
Generally, between about 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., that's when the UV levels are at their highest. So that doesn't mean that you're safe outside of those hours, though. But if you're spending long periods of time outdoors around midday, protecting your eyes becomes even more important. And this would be either, as I said, sunglasses, hats, or even umbrellas. So umbrellas aren't just for rainy days, you know, if you're out without your sunglasses or hat, for example, but you happen to have your umbrella in case of rain, then you could use it even though it's not raining. Even though it's not raining, sorry, just to protect the eyes a little bit more.
And why do people often get sore eyes after a day at the beach?
So that's a great question, because I have patients that tend to think that that irritation after a beach day is just because of the salt water irritating the eyes. And while salt water, sand, wind, and even the sunscreen getting into the eyes can certainly cause discomfort, the UV exposure is another important factor to consider that often goes overlooked, right? Now, at the beach, your eyes are actually exposed to more UV radiation than you might think. And that's because the sun is not just shining directly on your eyes from above, but it's also reflecting off of the water and the sand. So your eyes can be getting UV rays from multiple directions at once, which increases the overall exposure. If that exposure is intense enough, it could lead to the condition called photokeratitis, which we talked about, which is just the sunburn of the front surface of the eyes, right? And symptoms of that would usually develop a few hours after being in the sun. And it could include the things I mentioned, like redness, excessive tearing, pain, gritty sensation, and feeling like if you have sand in your eyes. Coincidental, because you're on the beach. And then you could also get blurred vision and extreme sensitivity to light. But the key thing there is that you wouldn't notice until a few hours later anyways. So you would have been in the sun for far too long before getting that photokeratitis, right? Now, the good news is that it's also very preventable. So if you're heading to the beach, again, probably sounding like a broken record, but wear the sunglasses that block 100% of the UVA and the UVB rays. And if you're careful enough, or if you have those little, they have little tags that you can attach to the back of the temples of the sunglasses, you can actually wear it while you're swimming too. You know, especially if you're not a heavy swimmer like me, like you're really just going to chill in the water, you could leave on your sunglasses and even your hat as well. Because I've seen plenty of people bathing in the beach with a wide brim hat just to protect the eyes and even your skin, you know, at the same time. So I would say, just like we remember to put sunscreen on our skin, as Mr. Lack had mentioned in the beginning, we should remember to protect our eyes too, especially during those very long days at the beach.
And if my prescription glasses darken in the sun, do I still need to wear sunglasses?
The photochromic lenses are excellent. So that's like, people know them as transitions. For many people, because they darken outdoors and provide that UV protection while having the convenience of just clearing up when they walk inside, right? However, many don't darken fully inside a car because the windshield blocks a lot of that UV that is needed to activate the transitions, for example. So I would explain that to my patients, and I give them the option, like, yes, you could do the transitions for, like, let's say in office all day, and then you just kind of pop out for lunch, like you just take a walk down the road and then come back, then that's fine. That's what the transitions are there for. But if you have a long commute home and you're facing the sun when you drive it home, like me, then I would switch to my sunglasses to drive home, actually. So you could actually get your prescription in your sunglasses so that you could see comfortably to drive or even walk around as well, right? It's a bit of an investment, but as I said, it's to benefit the eyes years later, you know?
And what's the one thing you wish everyone in Trinidad knew about UV safety?
I would love if everyone could think of sunglasses the same way that we think of, like, seatbelts. You know, we don't wait until you're in an accident to start wearing one, or at least I hope not. So UV damage could build silently over many years, as we've been explaining, and protecting your eyes today would help preserve your vision later on in life. So whether you're driving, walking to the grocery, watching cricket, fishing, spending a day at Maracas Beach, your eyes are working hard for you every day. So give them a little ease up, give them some protection in a small habit that could give you a lifelong amount of benefits. You know, so let's try to be more diligent in wearing our sunglasses and our hats and our wide brim hats and using our umbrellas if we don't have access to the other things as well.
Okay, great. And is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know as it pertains to UV safety or anything about their eye health in general as we're getting into the, of course, the summer vacation, July, August vacation?
Just try to adhere to as many, if not all, of the tips that we suggested today. And I mean, we only have so much time to explain things and, you know, we try to take a lot of our concerns from our patients and try to bring it to the session today. But I mean, y'all could always reach out to us. If you're in the area, you could always book an appointment with us to come and have a conversation about the eyes and how you could protect the eyes better from UV. So those of you that want to come in, you could always call 667-3115 or 299-3115 to book an appointment with us. And we are located at the corner of Queen and Susanna Street in Arima. And we'd be very happy to see you and talk about how to protect your eyes from the sun as best as you can.
Okay, thank you very much for telling us about UV safety. And I'm sure that we will have a very interesting topic the next time you guys come on as well.
All right, but before we go, we did have a couple of questions here that popped up. So can I ask these questions? Question one, can glaucoma drops negatively affect the eyes?
Glaucoma drops can have certain side effects that might irritate some patients more than others. So I'm just going to use one example. I have some patients that find that the drops dry out the eyes a little bit. So when you have dry eyes, you tend to feel things like grittiness, feeling like if you can't keep your eyes open, your vision would kind of come and go. But I mean, the glaucoma drops are more beneficial than not, because it's protecting the nerve at the back of the eyes, and that's kind of the source of your vision. So if the patient is trying to get at if using the glaucoma drops is a bad thing, definitely not. You need to use the glaucoma drops as prescribed by your ophthalmologist. And if you are getting those symptoms or side effects, then you could either have a conversation with that same ophthalmologist or your optometrist on maybe some lubricating eye drops to just ease that sensation.
All right, we did have one call on the line. Hello, good afternoon. Hello? Oh, that person left. Okay. All right, so that'll be it for today. Thank you, ladies.
Thank you.
All right, thank you for our friends out there, Dalton Brown Optometrist. And, of course, we have about 3 more minutes to the lunchtime, Doctor. So let's return to our topic there with the allergies. There was one question here. I don't know if this is an allergic situation. Using a Supirocin ointment makes my body very painful. Listen on here.
So when you're using certain ointments or anything that is new to the skin, now, if it is affecting your entire body when you're applying it to a localized area, we have to look for other reasons why this may be occurring as well. But it could be very plainly put, yes, it can be attributed to that, but it may not be the only thing that is contributing to the bodily pains. Because if you're using Supirocin ointments themselves, it means that there's a reason for you to be using this specific type of ointment, like a bacterial infection, because it is a topical antibiotic. Now, that is commonly prescribed for people who have certain skin disruptions due to bacteria, like small infected cuts, infected insect bites, minor skin infections as well. So it could not only be the ointment, it can be the underlying condition that you may have. So there are different reasons why you may be experiencing the bodily pains, but yes, you can attribute it to the ointment if it started only after the ointment, and if you only notice it after placing the ointment as well.
All right, and another question here as our final one as we wrap up the lunchtime, Doctor. Remember, of course, Dr. Brittany Dean is here with us today. Dr. Vasant Basdeo will be here with us tomorrow as we wrap up our questions here about the allergies. Let me just find it here. Yes, what are like a couple of important things every member of the public should know about severe allergic reactions that could one day save a life?
So first, you need to recognize the danger signs. So even if you don't know the person and you notice that they are having problems breathing and their throat or their tongue is swelling, they're wheezing, their voice has become hoarse, they are fainting, they're collapsing, or they're rapidly developing symptoms that involve several body systems after a possible allergen, understand what is going on. And second, you need to also understand that hives may be absent, so do not wait for a rash. And third, what you need to do is call for emergency help immediately. And the fourth thing to do is keep the person in a safe position. So generally, you want them lying down, not standing, not walking, with modification if they are having severe breathing difficulties or if the woman is pregnant. Now, fifth, you need to know that adrenaline, when we're looking at severe allergic reactions, is the first line life-saving treatment. And antihistamines, inhalers, steroids, home remedies, those cannot replace adrenaline. Now, the overall message is not that you need to start panicking when somebody itches or develops one hive. It is that you need to recognize the transition from a localized allergic reaction to a systemic emergency and act decisively based on the things that I've said just now. And just having everything in a calm, organized way, taking calm, organized action, so recognizing, calling for help, positioning them, and monitoring them, that can genuinely just save a life.
Hi, Doctor. Thank you there very much for your topic today.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.